This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, April 17th, 2005. Very excited about tonight's class. We were supposed to do one topic, and I changed it midweek in light of somewhat of a scandal that broke last Friday. And I wanted to speak very little about it at the very beginning, just so that people know what the impetus is, but also to emphasize that the class is not exactly about the scandal. The problem was, as you could probably find online, Rabbi Michael Broyd, prominent rabbi, Dayan, had set up an alias and was using it. I won't go into the details. If anyone's interested, feel free to search online. He was caught. He was exposed. He apologized, and he stepped down from his position. So I just want to say that out front, that as far as I'm concerned, the story's pretty much over. Right, and we'll discuss later on, towards the end, about that in terms of appropriate action. That was the impetus for this class, but the class is not about Rabbi Bori. The class is about what I call an introduction to rabbinic ethics, and I want to explain briefly why. Not having much to do with Rabbi Bori himself, as much as a lot of the reactions that I heard from people once the story broke, ranging from, oh, this wasn't such a big deal, to, oh, well, you know, he knows a lot of Torah. And these are the reactions of, you know, almost, you know, certain type of excusing of, you know, certain behaviors that I've heard a lot when a lot of other rabbis are caught doing things that they shouldn't have done, often for offenses that are a great deal more serious. And we don't really speak about rabbinic ethics as any sort of a requirement. To my knowledge, there is no rabbinical school that teaches rabbinic ethics. I would assume lawyers need at least one class in professional ethics. Doctors need to have a class in medical ethics. There is no, I don't think they instituted it, but certainly when I was there, offered no such class. I don't believe Chovave does. I don't believe JTS does. I don't believe HUC does. And it seems almost like we don't care about professional ethics for the rabbinate. Now, you can say, well, we assume rabbis ought to be ethical or to be held to a certain standard, but that's clearly not a given, and we'll see a little bit about that later. It's almost like if anyone, you know, remembers the dating process, getting set up with someone's like, oh, so-and-so is a nice person. It's like, well, of course a nice person. Who just set someone up with not a nice person? You almost take that for granted as a given, but as we, you know, there's some not nice people out there. Sometimes you get set up with them, and it leads to, you know, horrific dating stories. And you think with the rabbinate, it's kind of the same way, too. You expect rabbis to be ethical, but there are oftentimes rabbis who aren't. And by ethical, I mean this. You know, there's somewhat of a distinction you can make between rabbis who make isolated mistakes, right? And we'll talk a little bit about that later, versus, you know, people who know they're just not great people. Like, they're known to be difficult. Meaning, there's a difference, like, everyone's human, right? And you can slip up. You can have an error in judgment every now and again. But you also know people who are systematically, let's say, unethical or immoral, based on numerous interactions that you've had or based on stories that get out, because after all, you know, reputations do develop. And so what I want to, you know, do in this class is more of an introduction, because there really is a lot you can say on this, and there are a whole lot more sources. But at the very least, I want to start a discussion about it, and hopefully people who are listening can start thinking about it a little bit more in terms of defining who exactly is a great rabbi, because we tend to focus purely on the intellectual, or you might focus on accomplishments. How many followers, does someone have? How many degrees does someone have? How many books does someone have? Right? But we don't seem to focus on the ethical side, and that's what I want to show here today, that it is an important, if not superior, component that we as a Jewish community have tended to overlook, or have at the very least taken for granted, and I would like to try to reintroduce that such that it becomes a little bit, more prominent in our discussion, our evaluation about who exactly is a good rabbi, who is a great rabbi, and where should we start prioritizing. All right, so that's the focus. So I want to start off with some general responsibilities, not just of the rabbinate, but things that would apply to any sort of communal leader. She started us off with source number one. This is a Gemara in Brachot 55a. Andy?
Isaac said we must not appoint a leader of the community without first consulting it, as it says, "See, the Lord hath called by name Bezalel, son of Uri. The Holy One, blessed be he," said to Moses, "do you consider Bezalel suitable?" He replied, "Sovereign of the universe, if thou thinkest him suitable, surely I must also," said God to him. "All the same, go and consult them." He went and asked Israel, "Do you consider Bezalel suitable?" They replied, "If the Holy One, blessed be he, and you consider him suitable, surely we must."
So here, you would think God directly is appointing Bezalel to build a Mishkan, and still Moshe asks the Jewish people, "Hey, are you okay with this choice?" Right? What? Thoughts?
No, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, what particularly is interesting about it?
Well, I mean, you'd think that if God's opinion of somebody is all right, then, it's kind of a weird thing to... I don't know, it seems a little strange for Moshe, once he's getting the orders from God, to then go ask Jewish people, like, what are they going to say? No, we don't,
Okay, so what can we extrapolate from it? Because it certainly does seem odd. So according to this Gemara, it's almost like Kal Vachomer. If God's appointment still needs approval from the Jewish people, Kal Vachomer, by logical inference, we can assume like any other position of leadership requires approval of the Kehillah. So what does that tell you? Anything? Well, how about that a leader can't just, however great a person is, they can't just get up and impose their will on others, mm-hmm. right? There has to be some sort of acceptance behind it. The position of Jewish, and here the term is parnes, which is more of a generic term for leadership that does not, it's not Rav in particular, but I honestly don't see why it wouldn't apply to a Rav, right? You would, and there are actually other discussions about how a congregation, needs to accept, someone as their Rav. I say Lecha Rav, you actually choose someone, but it means that there has to be some a priori relationship with the congregation, that it's not just a top-down system where someone assigns, a diocese of like, here, you go over there, and everyone else is forced now to accept you simply because you say so. Next source, Gemara in Ta'anit 10b.
The rabbis have taught, "Let not a man say, I am but a disciple, and I am therefore not worthy to consider myself a Yahid, since all disciples of the wise are accounted Yahidim. Who is a Yahid, and who is a disciple? A Yahid is one worthy to be appointed leader of the community. A disciple is one who is asked any question of halacha connected with his studies and can answer it, even though it is on a subject dealt within the tractate Kala."
Right, which is something that's a little bit more obscure. So let's focus on these. You've got two things here. You've got one is a Talmid is someone who has a great deal of knowledge. Kol shesho alino to devar halacha v'talmudo, and he can answer you. Right, that's a Talmid, that's a student. But who is the Yachid? Who is considered an individual? Right, someone who is worthy, ra'ui l'manoto parnes alitzibor, who's worthy to be the head in that, again, that term of parnes, worthy to be a leader. So right here you have a distinction that the two are not necessarily go together. At least let me phrase that a little bit more precisely. Just because you happen to know a lot of stuff doesn't mean you're worthy to be a leader, right? You could have a photographic memory, know the entire Talmud by heart, and not be an appropriate leader. There's a distinction between the two. Continue.
Our rabbis have taught, not everyone desirous to consider himself a Yahid may do so. A disciple, however, may do so. This is the opinion of Rabbi Meir
Remeir. Stop.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, there's a period there, just the way to touch it. The way that the Talmud reads sometimes is they'll have a statement, and then the quote afterward, like the attribution at the end of the statement, followed by another attributed statement that disagrees with the previous one. So it takes a while to get used to how to read it, because it's a blah, 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 says so-and-so, someone else disagrees. So here's the someone else who disagrees.
Anyone may do so, and he may be remembered for good, because it is not an advantage to him, but a hardship. Another teaches, not everyone desires to consider himself, yeah, he may do so. A disciple, however, may do so. This is the opinion of Rabbi Simeon, son of Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Simeon Gamaliel says, this only applies to things which are to his distinction, but in things which cause him hardship, anyone may do so, and may he be remembered for good, because it is not an advantage to him, but a hardship.
So to be in this position of Yachid, and some of you may remember we discussed this in our class on stringencies, is considered, you know, not a plus, but a minus. Like, when you are in this position of Yachid, in this, like, elite leadership position, it's not all fun and games. You have a great deal more restrictions on you, right? In which case, you know, if you want to take on more restrictions, like, you know, fine. But the assumption isn't, like, you're doing it because you want to, like, there's an issue called yohara, when you act almost arrogantly, showing off your religious observance. But here it's a matter of, like, wait a second, if you want to act in this particular way and you want to take on all the stringencies, well, you got to take them all on. And that's not really a plus, that's really a negative, because there's so many responsibilities. Could you take Gemara Shabbat number Shabbat 114a? And here are some of the responsibilities, particularly of a Talmid Chacham.
Rabbi Hiya ben Abba said in Rabbi Yochanan's name, it is a disgrace for a scholar to go out with patched shoes into the marketplace. But Rabbi Aha ben Hanina did go out thus, said Rabbi Aha, son of Rabbi Naaman, the reference is to patches upon patches. Rabbi Hiya ben Abba also said in Rabbi Yohanan's name, any scholar upon whose garment a grease stain is found is worthy of death. For it is said, all they that hate me, all they that hate me love death. Read not Misana'ai,
but other Misana'ai. It's an Alti-Kri. It's where they take a certain word in Hebrew and they change the vocalization to mean something else. But fine. Then it gives a distinction about, you know, a thick patch. Don't deserve it. One first to an upper garment, the other to a shirt. So you've got two statements here about the dress of a Talmid Chacham. Right? Should not go out with at least double patched shoes, and shouldn't go out with a stain. Any thoughts on that? Right, in terms of, like, ethical violations, there are worse things that people can do, mm-hmm. right, than go out with stained clothing. So what do you think this means?
Well, it could be another Kal Komer kind of a thing, right? If they can't even go out with, like, a grease stain on them, then certainly there's all the more evil stuff definitely shouldn't be done by somebody like that.
Interesting. Huh. But is it really evil to go out with a grease stain?
No.
So, I mean, yeah. Any ideas?
About standing.
Explain.
Stature. I mean, the person represents himself to be someone who's priestly or who's rabbinical. They have to act the part, and that's their appearance needs to be such. You know, whether it's the white shirt without a stain, the perfection. Mm-hmm. You need to exemplify perfection. I think that's.
I think that's, if not perfection, because no, I think that's the way I would have explained
it.
Or if not purity, at least say respect the office.
Right.
Exactly.
Respecting the office of the president, the office of the authority.
The language of Rambam is, you know, I think he uses the term in Hilchot Deot of Na'evin Aki, at least dress properly, dress appropriately. Okay? Now, of course, what this means is relative to your community, but if you're going to be a prominent figure, and let's think about what does it mean to be a prominent figure.
Yeah, you have to have a stain to be a prominent figure.
You need to what?
You need to actually have a few stains to be prominent.
Oh, yes. But, like, you know, if you're talking about, like, really being up there, okay, the more prominent you are, the more eyes are going to be looking upon you. And if you're going to be perceived as a representative of Judaism, and by extension a representative of God, it's, you know, you'd say, like, why are we, you know, concerned with how you look and how you appear? And the answer is, you know, yes, you can say, yes, we should really all be about the spiritual stuff, but that's not just your job. I mean, there's more than just knowing stuff. There's an element about how do you present yourself to other people. Now, granted, you know, people make mistakes. People spill stuff, you know, all the time, but at least to have in the back of your head, not that you have to dress in, you know, $4,000 Brooks Brothers suits, but at least realize there's an important component to your rabbinate of how do you present yourself to other people.
in a way that is at least appropriate to your constituency. Okay? And again, there's more to being a rabbi, or at least in terms of the, again, this is under the general responsibilities, than just knowledge. Right? There's how do you deal with other people. Let's do one more. Some of you might be familiar with this. Mishnah in Avot 111.
Okay. Avtalion said, sages must be careful with their words, lest you be condemned to exile and be exiled to a place of evil waters, and the disciples who follow you drink and die, and the name of heaven will be profaned.
Why do you think this is? Chachamim hisaru b'divrechem. Sages have to be careful with their words. Why do you think that is? And why do you think not doing so would lead you to exile?
Well, maybe because you're going to have followers. I mean, you say something and people are going to, you know, they'll hear what you say. Whereas if I say something or, you know, somebody who's not necessarily in the public spotlight does something, they only affect yourself. Whereas maybe a sage, you know, it's kind of like a snowball effect.
Yeah. When you're in a position of authority, there's a greater likelihood that people are going to take what you say seriously, whether or not you think they will. One of the weird things that's come up with the internet, right? When you have, you know, you don't necessarily think, like, who's going to do what with the material, because all your stuff is now more accessible, means you got to be a lot more careful with what you say, right? But this is, again, turning an eye towards not just knowledge, but how do you relate to the people around you? Now, it's just like being careful. There are many ways that you need to be careful with how you speak. Sometimes it's a matter of precision. Sometimes it's what you say. Sometimes it's how you say it. And sometimes it's when not to say. Right? Doesn't mean that you avoid controversy, but you could argue, you know, the more controversial you're going to be, the more careful and the more precise you have to be. Right? If you're just going to go up and repeat stuff, you know, fine. But, you know, unless someone's like really going to hang on every word that you say. You know, I've given even the analogy here. You know, when I started recording things, I was very nervous about like going on tape, but it hit me. You know, I'm not close to the level of Rav Soloveitchik or of Herschel Schachter or a lot of other people where students will harp on every single word that they say. And I'll think that since every single word was chosen with precision, you can start analyzing why did he say this and why did he, you know, say that. And the more prominent you are, the more people are hanging on every word, the really the more careful that, you know, you have to say. And it's not even that necessarily people are going to follow you, but let's not forget that people aren't always consistent. And if you just, you know, throw something off the cuff once, people say, oh, I heard so-and-so say this, right? People might not always know if you're joking, okay? There are just so many ways that someone can take a statement of a rabbi and turn to any number of ways. I actually even had that here, where I was talking about a particular issue in shul, we're waiting for a minion. There was someone who was here first time ever and didn't realize that, you know, when we have, like, the open-ended halachic discussions, anything goes, and we start talking about hypotheticals. And the person thought, like, wow, you know, this rabbi's completely nuts. To, like, you know, stayed around, and, you know, to give her a lot of credit, actually, like, put in the effort to think a little bit more, and, like, to find out more, instead of just jumping to conclusions. But, you know, all you need to do is go to a rabbi, you hear them once, they say one thing that's stupid, you can easily have a negative impression of that individual and then start disseminating that to other people. And there's absolutely no way for you to know, especially if you're a rabbi of a large congregation and people keep coming and going, if that's the only thing that they hear of you, you're completely stuck. Right? Mm-hmm. So it's an important line again for just how careful you need to be. In terms of next section, personal disposition, and this gets a little bit more complicated. Because now you're not dealing so much with the, you know, ethics point, but what is the appropriate disposition of a rabbi? And you're going to find multiple opinions here. One is a verse from Ecclesiastes, Kohelet 9:17. Divrei chachamim benachat nishma'im mizakat moshel baksilim. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. That's probably not a great translation. I just copied online. Right, some people like shouting, right? Like doing the fire and brimstone. That might work for some people. Others, you know, prefer, you know, quiet, you know, logic. And you can say that, well, maybe there's a little bit of both, but ideally, it's not about, you know, the volume, but about the content. Of course, in practice, that doesn't always work, right? Quite often, people are seduced by style over substance without sitting back and thinking, hey, what did the person say? Let me just give one, you know, slight digression before we go on. There's Rabbi Goldwicht. who's a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. Really sweet, fine person. And there was someone who came out of his class who was just gushing about what a wonderful shiur he gave. Now, one criteria about Rav Goldwicht is he usually gives shiur in Hebrew. And the guy was just gushing about it. Like, if you ever see Rav Goldwicht, he pretty much always has a smile on his face. Like, one of the most positive dispositions. This guy's like, "Oh, it's a great class by Rav Goldwicht." And I asked, I was like, "Well, what'd he say?" "Oh, it was just amazing." And he kept trying to hang, like, "What did he say?" I had no idea, right? Now, that's not a flaw with Rav Goldwicht per se, but I'm just giving that as an example. If someone's just so caught up in, you know, the persona and the disposition, what Rav Goldwicht said was kind of irrelevant. I wasn't there, so I have no idea what he said. But, you know, I'm sure you can come up with other, you know, with other examples. I want to continue with Sanhedrin 92a.
Rav Eliezer said, "Every leader who leads the community with mildness would be privileged to lead them in the next world, too, as it is written, 'For he that had mercy on them shall lead them, even by the springs of the water shall he guide them.
Right, so here you have that word nachat again. You know, and this is a pretty hard thing to do. Right? And there are also other things about not doing with excessive fear, but whatever. But according to this Gemara, there seems to be a premium on nachat. Right? Doing so with pleasantly. However, take Gemara Yoma 22b23a.
Rabbi Yohanan further said in the name of Rabbi Simeon B. Yehoshadak, "Any scholar who does not avenge himself and retain anger like a serpent is no real scholar."
So stop here for a second. This is a pretty big statement here. Right? Kol tamid chacham she'eno nokem v'eno ter kenachash, eno tamid chacham. The exact opposite. This would seem that a scholar is supposed to hold a grudge like a snake. That's, you know, that's a pretty big statement there. Continue with the Gemara.
"But is it not written, 'Thou shalt not take vengeance nor bear any grudge'? That refers to monetary affairs, but does not this prohibition apply to personal affliction? Has it not been taught concerning those who are insulted but do not insult others in revenge, who hear themselves reproached without replying, who perform good work out of love of the Lord and rejoice in their sufferings? Scripture says, 'But they that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might.' That means indeed that he keeps it in his heart, though without taking action. But Rava said, 'He who passes over his retaliations has all his transgressions passed over.' That speaks of the case that an endeavor was made to obtain his reconciliation, and his consent is obtained."
Right, so there are a couple of exceptions here. One is that you hold on to it, but you don't do anything about it. You know, you kind of call that repressing. Probably not the healthiest things to do. But why, you know, this is a... And there's also a distinction about if someone asks you for forgiveness and you're getting past that. Right? So according to this Gemara, Rabbi is supposed to, Tamid Chacham is supposed to hold on to rage. What do you think about that? Why do you think that should be?
Well, it's almost like the speech you gave a couple of weeks ago, right? It's good to hold a grudge. You quoted the... Sure, you quoted the fashion designer.
Ah, right, that one. I'm sorry, I give a lot of jar shirt here, so I honestly forget what I said.
The fashion designer said the people are
right.
Too quick to forgive.
Ah, right. That was from a few sometimes.
It just reminds me of that a little bit.
Okay, so why do you think specifically a rabbi, or not just, I mean, I'm using the term interchangeably, a Tamid Chacham, but why should a Tamid Chacham here not be too quick to forgive? Why is it important specifically for a Tamid Chacham to hold on to it?
You know, above an ordinary or above a non-Tamid Chacham.
It mentions here specifically, mm-hmm. right? Any Tamid Chacham that does not hold a grudge and maintain rage like a serpent isn't a genuine Tamid Chacham. Which means, according to, you know, Rav Yochanan in the name of Shimon ben Yehotzadak, this is an important component. Why? What do you think? No one? Well, okay, so since you remember the drasha, why is it important to hold on to a grudge sometimes?
Well, according to that, you had said that it was because if you don't hold a grudge, we almost like become like just kind of like without our roots, without our foundation, just kind of flap around in the wind.
Sort of a metaphor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. I mean, the grudge is not really the issue. It's contextually understanding. You know, that there may be an issue, and if you lose sight of it. you know, as well. You're never going to address it, or you're never going to. You know, so I think it's closure. It's not. You know, there needs to be some level of closure. I would refer to it as closure.
Yeah, this doesn't seem to be from the closure perspective, because closure would be you get past it. Here, it's almost like you're
holding
on to it.
Closure in the sense that, you know, you're never going to achieve closure if you just allow it to disappear, which is to say that you just blow it off, put it up, brush under the carpet, brush under the rug type of thing.
Interesting.
So this is, you know, I don't mean closure as in that point, but in the sense, contextually, you know, historical perspective, to have them to remember it so that you can, you know, resolve it. I mean, or to prevent it from happening again, or to address it.
You know, it's an interesting read. I honestly didn't read it that way. And the reason is because it seems to be like you're still trying to, you know, hold on to it. Meaning closure doesn't seem to be, from the statement here, it doesn't seem like you're trying to get past it.
But what I meant by closure is I didn't mean closure as in, I meant by closure is that, you know, you need to have finality in that.
Ah, okay.
And the finality can't occur until you've dissected it. Right. Until you've had time for it to brew. You need that intensity to allow, you know, the finality to occur. I mean,
maybe.
But that's, you know, that's perhaps a mild version of that.
Well, the way that, you know, I would see it is, you there are times when if you overlook certain things, it's very easy to turn into a doormat. Yeah, there's certain discussions about certain people, certain positions are required to have certain type of kavod, right? You have to honor your parents. You have to honor a king. And there are occasions when someone is not allowed to be mochel on their kavod. A person cannot say, you know what, for my honor, you know what, I can do without it, right? Now, I'm not saying in this particular respect that, you know, a rabbi is out seeking honor, but there's a difference of, you know, if someone who's a leader who doesn't actually hold on to it. Now, granted, quite a few rabbis working professionally are mistreated. Very few rabbis have the ability to do anything about it. But once you start accepting this as the norm, then what happens? You start, you know, it's almost like being in an abusive relationship. You think that this is appropriate, right? And once you start thinking it's appropriate, you lose the ability, really, to be a rabbi, to be a leader. To give just one mashal, somewhat related, Rambam writes that a requirement for a prophet is that he has to be financially wealthy, independently wealthy. And my father's teacher, Chacham Yosef Or, explained, because you can't give musar, you can't rebuke people when you're in their pocket. Right? It's, you know, it's weird that the rabbinate's one of the few jobs you can get fired for doing your job. Right. Let's say you're, you know, there's a rabbi of a synagogue where there's a lot of wife swapping, right? And you get up and you start saying, "Yeah, by the way, you really shouldn't commit adultery." And it's like, "Yeah, well, we don't want a rabbi who's going to tell us that." So his contract is up; he's gone. In which case, he can't talk about it, right? If that's the things that a rabbi gets accustomed to and doesn't hold on to that, then he starts, you know, I think you use the idiom of like floating out in the wind, of like loses the ability to really be in a position of religious leadership.
But that, contextually, that's what I was saying, to finality. You can never allow it to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to use it. You have to use it when it's the appropriate time.
Right.
So if you forget about it and you just brush it off and you just don't worry about it, it disappears. That's exactly what
I was saying. So it says here, olam denakit lebelibe, that you keep it in your heart.
Right,
meaning,
right.
You might not take revenge on the individual who wronged you. You might not be able to, but if you sort of hold it in the back that you've been wronged, you might be able to prevent it in the future, either from this person or from someone else. Because once you start living your life as a leadership completely to the dictates of everyone else, you're not going to be much of a leader. As they say in football, when the coach starts coaching to the stands, he's soon going to be sitting there. Meaning if he keeps making, you know, decisions because that's what everyone else wants, you're not going to last long. And there's actually, despite that, there's a Gemara in Ta'anit that sort of tries to seek a balance. This is Ta'anit 4a.
Rav further said, if a young scholar gets into a rage, it is because the Torah inflames him. As it is said, is not my word like a fire? And said the Lord. Rabbi Ashi said, a scholar who is not as hard as iron is no scholar. As it is said, and like a hammer that breaketh the rock in pieces, Rabbi Abba said to Rabbi Ashi, "You have learned this from that verse, but we have learned it from the following verse. A land whose stones are iron." Do not read stones.
Ah, you got this. You got another altikri. Good for you. Right, this art of Avanena stones, but rather Bonah, builders. Say again, Avanah, it's not Avanah, but rather Bonah. Another type of, you know, textually. This happens not infrequently. Sorry you got stuck with both of them. It's not just you, right? Anyway, continue. Ravina said,
"Despite this, a man should train himself to be gentle, for it is said, therefore remove vexation from thy heart," etc.
Right. So here, you know, you have sort of a little bit of both, right? There's supposed to be the passion of Torah, right? And if someone gets angry, it should really be the Torah that motivates. And let's face it, you know, if someone is really ethical and really motivated by stuff, it's not uncommon to hear people like be very impassioned because they believe in it. But still, Ravina says you should still try to train yourself to be gentle. And I think it's a really difficult balance. How do you be passionate? How do you stick to your guns with things while also being gentle? It's a big issue that comes up with Musar, with how do you give rebuke to someone else? It might actually, you know, that could be worthwhile for a shiur in its own right, right? Because someone, if I see someone doing something wrong, do you go with a tough love, right? Do you say, this is the worst ethical thing in the world? Or do you try doing it a little bit calmer? My father likes using the idiom, are you trying to win arguments or people? You know, in which, you know, like, I can out-logic someone to, you know, convince you that something's like, yeah, he's right, but whatever, I'm going to do what I want anyway. But if I want to actually affect someone's behavior, you know what? Doing something, nachat, and here uses, again, that word in the Aramaic root, nichuta, right? Using nachat can sometimes, you know, win. In which case, there's a rabbi from at least the sources that I'm citing, and I admit I'm cherry-picking sources. There's plenty more here, and this is only supposed to be an introduction. There seems to be a conflict here of internal strength and external gentleness. You hold on to, you know, whatever is internally. You don't necessarily let that out towards others. Rambam even writes something about this with getting angry. Parents should never actually get angry. They should act angry with their children to, you know, show them, but they should not actually be angry. Right? And here, you know, it's almost the inverse of, like, you can hold on to it, but there's a, like, you're supposed to hold on to that passion, but how is it that you're supposed to communicate that to everyone else, especially when you're having this incredibly big responsibility of representing Judaism, and again, by extension, God, to everyone else? And finally, Mishnah in this section, at least Mishnah Avot 4:12.
Rabbi Eliezer ben Shmua said, "Let the honor of your student be as dear to you as your own, and the honor of your colleague like the reverence for your teacher, and the reverence for your teacher as the fear of heaven."
Right? So, you know, you could do a logical, you know, inference here, right? To say you've got three stays here, you know, you've got, if the honor of your colleague should be like your teacher, the honor for your teacher should be like fear of heaven, then logically, the honor of your colleague should be like the fear of heaven. Mm-hmm. Notice that it's your student should be that of your own, which is fascinating, because there's a bit of a shift there, meaning, you know, it's almost like you treat your colleagues better than yourself, but you should treat your students no worse. And this is also a fairly, you know, difficult thing to consider, where, you know, sometimes, you know, teachers have to be harsh. Now, does that mean that you're not treating them with honor? Of course not, right? Different people have different pedagogic styles, but there's a way of being harsh while still treating someone with respect. And again, different people have, you know, different standards, but I also know of Rebbeim who do not treat their students with a shred of respect, or at least certainly not to the respect that they would wish for themselves. But at the very least, I mean, this is only, again, a short smattering here, but for as much as we talk about Kavod HaRav, and there are plenty of sources, actually I have another shiur on this, and some of the sources were taken from that in rabbinic leadership in general, rabbis will, you know, very frequently will talk about, here's how you're supposed to treat the rabbis, but very rarely will they talk about the other side of the obligations. And the truth is, it's a mutual obligation. Yes, you know, the masses are supposed to treat rabbis with a certain degree of respect, probably a great deal of respect. But by the same token, rabbis are supposed to treat everyone else with respect too, if not held to a higher standard. And when you only focus on one to the exclusion of the other, you have an imbalance.
And I think the sources here kind of show that you've got, you know, I focus specifically here on the obligations that a rabbi would have in terms of relating to the constituency, which are not insignificant, but again, unfortunately, are not actually taught in any rabbinical school. So, moving along to some of the questions, moving on to, I call this tentatively the importance of, ethical rabbinic behavior, but specifically in contrast of ethical behavior, so as compared to the Torah knowledge. And how do these two relate to each other? So here's a Gemara in Yoma, 72b. Rava said, any scholar whose inside is not like his outside is no scholar. Kol tamid chacham she'eno tocho kevaro, eno tamid chacham. Abaye, or some say Rabba, name of the son of Arula, said, he is called abominable. As it is said, how much less that one is an abominable and an impure man. I mean, in Hebrew, it's a nit'ev, right? You might remember the nit'ev. It's, remember that to'eva that people like signing in other contexts. How much less that one is abominable and pure man who drinketh iniquity like water. Or Samuel ben Nachmani, the name of Rav Yochanan, what is the meaning of the scriptural statement? Wherefore, there is a price in the hand of a fool to buy wisdom, seeing he hath no understanding, i.e., woe unto the enemies of scholars who occupy themselves with Torah, but have no fear of heaven. Rav Yanai proclaimed, woe unto him who has no court, but makes a gateway for his court. Rav said to the sages, I beseech you, do not inherit a double Gehenna. Rav Joshua ben Levi said, what is the meaning of the scriptural verse? And this is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel. If he is meritorious, it becomes from a medicine of life, if not a deadly poison. That is what Rav meant when he said, if he uses it the right way, it is a medicine of life unto him. He who does not use it the right way, it is a deadly poison. So here, we have an explicit contrast. Just because you are knowledgeable in the Torah, just because you know a whole lot of stuff, if you do not behave properly, not only is it worthless, but it's actually a negative. It can do a lot more harm. One, you're not really a scholar, according to Rava. Two, it's called a toeva, an abomination. Three, you're considered an enemy of the Torah scholars. Sonei hen shel talmidei chachamim. Almost like you are an imposter because you're going to bring everyone down. If you remember what we saw with the Chilul Hashem class, if you act immorally to the point where people will say, this is what learning Torah gets, you actually ruin it for everyone else. Mm-hmm. It's like a prominent rabbi who messes up. It's like, look at the rabbinate. Look how worthless they are. Right? And it's why, you need a lot of internal controls to say, yeah, this shouldn't happen, and we're actually going to censure our own people, because if you don't, you lose entire credibility. And it's also, at the end, considered a poison. If someone learns Torah, but does not actually, use it the right way, as it's, said here. Right? Torah can be manipulated, and unfortunately has been, to get people to do lots of things. Or used as a kardom lach porba, a spade with which to dig, to use the idiom in Pirkei Avot. But if you don't have that ethical foundation behind it, it is completely worthless. So for those who say, yeah, the guy's a bit of a jerk, but he knows stuff, you can gain a certain amount of information from him. Right? Rav Meir studied from Elisha ben Avuya, even after Elisha ben Avuya became a heretic. Right? Someone might still know stuff, you can still might gain knowledge, but there's a very big difference between knowledge and Torah. Right? There's a difference between, I can know a lot of Gemara, I can know a lot of Tanakh, I can know the Bible and rabbinic sources backwards and forwards, but unless you have that ethical component there, you know information, you don't know Torah. And there's a very big distinction there. Here's another example. There's a Gemara in Ta'anit 7a.
Rava pointed out a contradiction. It is written, my doctrine shall drop as the rain. And immediately on this follows, my speech shall distill as dew. The implication here is, if the scholar is a worthy person, then he is like unto dew. But if he's not, then drop him like rain. It has been taught in Baharita, Braita, Rabbana used to say, whosoever occupies himself with the Torah for its own sake, his learning becomes an elixir of life to him. For it is said, it is a tree of life to them that grasp it. And it is further said, it shall be as health to thy navel. And it is also said, for whoso findeth me findeth life. But whosoever occupies himself with the Torah, not for his own sake, it becomes to him a deadly poison. And as it is said, my doctrine shall drop as the rain. And Arifa surely means death, as it is said. And they shall break, wherefore the heifer's neck there in the valley.
Continue.
Rabbi Yirmeyahu said to Rav Zera, pray, Master, come and teach. The latter replied, I do not feel well enough, and I'm not able to do so. Then said Rabbi Jeremiah, pray, Master, expound something of an agadic character. And he replied, thus said Rabbi Yochanan, what is the meaning of the verse? For is the tree of the field man? Is then man the tree of the field? This can only be explained if we connect the verse with the words immediately before it, where it is written, for thou mayest eat of them, but thou shalt not cut them down. But then again it is written, if thou shalt destroy and cut down, how is this to be explained? If the scholar is a worthy person, learn from him and do not shun him, but if he is not, destroy him and cut him down.
So there's a certain worthiness, meaning im talmid chacham hagun, which usually refers to appropriateness of, you know, because he's still called talmid chacham, right? If someone, you know, as I said before, earlier, if you're learning Torah not for its own sake, for other purposes, it can be a poison. Finally, if there's someone who's a talmid chacham, who is not hagun, who does not conduct himself appropriately, you're supposed to cut him down. This is a pretty harsh statement here, too. Again, implying that however much someone knows, if you don't have derech eretz, completely meaningless. Or I think my grandfather says it the best. You know, he says, doesn't matter how much you know, first important thing, be a mensch. Might have heard something like that. And he's right. I mean, I doubt that he saw these Gemaras, but he's absolutely correct. According to these Gemaras, if you know a lot of stuff, but you lack the morals, you lack the ethics, doesn't matter how much you know, irrelevant, you're not really a gadol. Okay? Next section. Standards of ethical rabbinic behavior. Take number 12. Gemara Chulin 44b.
Rabbi, he says, said, who is a scholar? He who would declare his own animal trefa.
Meaning he would say his own animal isn't kosher. Why do you think this is a sign of the Talmid Chacham? Not your question here.
Because he's able to, I guess, see even his own situations from kind of an outside view. And even if there's something in his best interest, he doesn't necessarily rule in that favor. He does what he thinks is right.
Exactly! Right? When you declare your own animal a trefa, it means you're losing money. It means I can't eat this anymore. So one criteria for a Talmid Chacham is like, you know what? This isn't good. I can't do this anymore. Right? A certain standard of ethical behavior. I could have even thrown... Yeah, all right. And you know what? Since I was small, continue with this. Is a Gemara in Sanhedrin 7b to 7a.
You shall not respect persons in judgment. Rabbi Judah says this means you shall not favor anyone. And Rabbi Eliezer takes it to mean you shall not estrange anyone, even if he is your enemy.
So there's a biblical prohibition of lo takir panim b'mishpat. You're not allowed to recognize someone in front of your court, and this can go one of two ways. One, you don't show favor to people you like, and you also don't show disfavor to people you dislike. Continue.
A former host of Rav came before him with a lawsuit and said, were you not once my guest? Yes, he answered. And what is your wish? I have a case to be tried, he replied. Then said Rav, I am disqualified from being your judge. And turning to Rabbi Kahana, said, go you and judge the case. Rabbi Kahana noticed that the man presumed too much on his acquaintance with Rav, so he remarked, if you will submit to my judgment, well and good. If not, I shall put Rav out of your mind by showing you my authority.
All right, so what happened here?
somebody kind of thought that Rob was going to do him a favor because they were kind of buddies, or at least he had him over one time, and Rob said, no, I can't.
Well, even before that, he's like, were you not once my guest? He said, like, yeah. It's like, I have, well, you know, can I do something? It's like, yeah, I want a case feature. I was like, nope, can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. The sense was, someone did a favor for him before, may not even have been connected. Right? He says, what? Can't do it. Why? I might be biased. This is a certain standard of ethical behavior, right? Because if, you know, one of the litigants is going to say, you know, again, like you said, the buddy-buddy thing, right? I know someone. You have in American court system, when there's an interest, a judge is supposed to recuse himself, mm-hmm. right? Same deal here. Unfortunately, it's very difficult, you know, to really enforce that today. But you could imagine, you know, if a rabbi, you try taking a rabbi to a Beis Din, you know, how do you find the Beis Din where they don't actually know the individual? Unless they actually say, you know what, even though I know the individual, you know, you have to trust me that I can do it. But that's on the table. At the very least, it needs to be addressed. But Rav, right, his take was, I have to recuse myself. No one told him to do so, but this is the standard to which he held himself, right? And this is a fairly trivial thing. It's like, it would be like saying, like, oh, you had me over for a Shabbos dinner once. Nope, can't serve on your basin because you did something nice for me. Right? That's a pretty high standard. Right? Continue, next paragraph.
Ye shall hear the small and the great alike. Resh Lakish says, this verse indicates that a lawsuit involving a mayor... Peruta must be regarded as of the same importance as one involving 100 mina.
A peruta was the smallest unit of currency that they had, like the smallest significant amount of money.
For what practical purpose is this laid down? If it is to urge the need of equal consideration and investigation, it is not self-evident. Rather, it is to give the case due priority if it should be first in order.
Now, this would be in terms of, you know, how a judge ought to behave in that position. You don't treat, you know, a case involving $100 more important than the case of $1 just because it has more money, right? In order for you to act, the criteria for acting ethically is the law is what matters. It's not the prestige. It's not, you know, how important are the litigants or the significance of the case. It's people are trying to have their stuff adjudicated in front of you in the name of Torah. You have to follow the Torah what it is. So if the next court on the docket, you know, is worth $50, you do it. You don't bump up. It's like, well, this next one is worth $50,000, so that takes precedence. Like, no, comes the way it's supposed to come. Right? And it says it even should be obvious that it should be in terms of how much effort you put into the Drishan Chakira, how much you put into, you know, the effort you put into deciding who's actually right in this case. You don't just say, it's only like a buck. You know, here, take it, no one cares. Right? Because you're representing the system of Torah. And finally,
for the judgment is God's. Rabbi Hama, son of Rabbi Hanina, comments, the Holy One, blessed be He, hath said, it is not enough for the wicked judges that they take away money from one and give it to another unjustly, but they put me to the trouble of returning it to its owner.
Yeah, I love this last line in Agadita. It's sort of like God saying, you know, there are, you know, acknowledging that there are wicked judges, you know, people who don't do their diligence. Like, it's bad enough that you're taking the money away from the from people who deserve it, right? Because that's what judges do. When you accept and this is why, you know, we ought to hold judges to a high standard, because you're giving a judge the authority to take money from you and give it to someone else. That's a pretty big deal. Or at least for me it is, because I just don't have that. Well, actually, the truth is, it's for anyone, because they could set any amount. So no matter how much money you have, it can always be a big deal. So this is a great agadita, because God is saying, you know what? It's bad enough that you're messing, you know, you're messing around with my law. You're screwing around with the halacha about the way things are supposed to be. But now I have to go fix it through my divine cosmos way of making sure that the balance shifts. Like, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, and you're giving me more work. You know, and it's a very weird way of, you know, thinking about it. It's like, it's, you know, God, obviously, like, this isn't a theological statement as much as trying to remind people that when you're going to a Din Torah, right, judges are supposed to be acting and rendering a decision in line with halacha, their decisions are ostensibly God's will.
Which, again, if you think about it in such ways, is a pretty heavy responsibility. It's, for me, at least, it's more of an intimidating responsibility than going on a power trip of like, haha, you know, I can tell other people what to do. It's like, wait, I'm in a role where I'm acting as God's agent. That's, you know, if you actually think about that for a second, you want to approach it with a great deal of reverence. And, you know, this I got it to sort of, you know, hammers it home, that if you mess up, God's got to fix your problem. And, you know, if anyone's read Tanakh, you don't really want to get God angry. Yeah, I'm not going to even make the Incredible Hulk reference. So let's, you know, address some of the, you know, addressing a bit of unethical rabbinic behavior. Although, actually, you know, this should actually go in the, I'll move this up to the previous section. Can you do source number 14, please? I'll move it up to the next previous section when I print it up.
What is the cunning rogue like? Rav Yochanan says, he who explains his case to the judge before the other party to the suit arrives. Rav Zirika said in the name of Rav Huna, he who is lenient with himself and strict with others.
Right, so the main point is this last one from Rav Zirika's opinion. There are actually a few others. If you are lenient with yourself and strict with others, you are called a Risha Arum. What do you think that means for a rabbi? Anyone?
Hypocritical?
Well, you could say hypocritical, sure.
Well, if you're lenient for yourself and you're strict with others.
Well, I'll give you an example, something that came up this past year. There was a rabbi in Israel who came out very, very emphatically in public saying iPhones are usser. You can't have an iPhone. Unfiltered internet. And he was photographed in a car with an iPhone. And, you know, and he came out like, you know, when he came out with, you know, a really, I'm blanking on the adjective here, incredibly defensive, almost an attacking thing of like, how dare you attack me? Like, I asked this particular rabbi and he gave me a special dispensation because of Kiruv, because I'm doing outreach, blah, 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 blah. Still, that's Mekil al Atzmo v'machmir al Achirim. You're holding other people to a higher standard than yourself. And we gave a whole separate class on, you know, stringencies, where, you know, if I want to be strict on myself, that's my business, right? And I can say, like, I'm strict for, you know, such and such a reason. But for me to say, you know, as a matter, and it's also different than saying, you know, if someone asks me what they think they should do, and I say, well, here I would recommend being strict, that may or may not be a particular, you know, wouldn't necessarily come under that category. So, for example, you know, I use the example of someone happens to be an alcoholic. So I might say, hey, you should really take on stringencies, you know, not to be around alcohol, even though, you know, I'm not, you know, an alcoholic. So for me, it's not a big deal. That's not me killing that smoke of Machmir al Achirim, because you're giving someone very specialized advice for a particular case. The way that I understand this is, you know, like a rabbi who gets up and he says, everyone else ought to do so, but not me. And you're exactly right in terms of the hypocrisy. Because hypocrisy isn't, you know, people often, you know, misinterpret what the word hypocrisy means. I don't think it means someone who doesn't live up to a particular standard. It's more of what's good for good for me, but not good for thee, or vice versa, right? You know, I can say, here are certain things that are halacha, right? And I will tell people that are halacha. Do I live up to my own standard? No, because I'm a flawed human being, as are many people. That doesn't mean that that's necessarily hypocritical, because I'm saying, yeah, what I'm doing is wrong, right? That's not hypocrisy, because I'm acknowledging it's wrong.
The other area, I think, which is a little bit different, is that the rabbi, you know, perhaps may feel that he can manage the, instead of building the wall fully around, he can manage, you know, better than you and I can, and therefore he could be lenient and you can't. I mean, that's the other side of it. I mean, I'm not saying it's good or bad, but it's like he could control.
So, you know, it's funny you mention that. There's actually a whole separate class I have on that topic, or at least it discusses it, called...
I'm not saying it's right, but there's, you know...
You're raising a fantastic point on, you know, what I call halacha v'in morin kein. But the difference is this. You know, there are discussions like that, but you can't actively get up. There's a difference between saying, how to put this, I'm not going to teach something, and I'll try to manage it my own way. Here you have a flat-out double standard. of I am going to tell everyone else, here's what you ought to do, versus here's what I am going to do. Or even if not here's what you ought to do, here's what the halakha is, but I'm going to do something else.
The example about the filters, that I know that I can control my emotions, I don't have a problem, I don't need the filters. Whereas a young child, or contextually someone else, may not have that control level, so it was recommended not to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, that's sort of...
In which case it's qualified.
Right, it's qualified.
But if I get up and I say it's a flat-out esor of a prohibition, and such that it's for everyone, that's mekil al atzmo v'machmir al acherim. I'm going to set up a standard for other people that I have no intention of keeping myself, or I'm going to find my own dispensation to get around it. Right? That's not appropriate. Now, what I could do in such a case is, instead of saying the fire and brimstone of like, hey, it's usser, is to be a little bit more measured in what I say or how I present it.
But I think that's the whole concern that I have over halacha is how the rabbinical authorities go about discussing and how they go about communicating what halacha is and how to go about interpreting halacha. And I think that's, I think, a bigger thing. I think that's a bigger issue, quite frankly, than the halacha itself.
Well, that's, I would agree. And this would actually go to, this would be one general thing of which, if you are careful with what you say, you will avoid doing so. Right? And that might mean, going through some nuance. All right? Gemara Bracha 19a. So this would be, what are some ways of addressing unethical rabbinic behavior? Because let's face it, rabbis are humans. No one on earth is completely righteous and doesn't sin. It happens, right? So what do you do when this happens?
It was taught in the school of Rav Ishmael, if you see a scholar who has committed an offense by night, do not cavil at him by day, for perhaps he has done penance.
Meaning tshuva. Yeah.
Perhaps, say you, nay. Oh, perhaps, say you, nay, rather, he has certainly done penance.
Has certainly done penance, meaning, what do you mean, maybe he did tshuva, like shema, right, possibly. It's like, of course he did tshuva. So?
This applies only to bodily sexual offenses, but if he has misappropriated money, he may be criticized until he restores it to its owner.
Any thoughts on this? Right? If you see someone doing something wrong sexually, you're supposed to give him the benefit of the doubt that he did tshuva. So Talmid Chacham. But if he did money, not until you see, money get given back. What do you think? Why the distinction here? Come on.
If you see somebody doing sexually, there's nothing all that much you can do. It's what's done is done. Money can at least be returned.
That's a good point. Yeah.
One can kind of be undone, whereas one is really not undoable.
Restitution. Restitution is required, and that's what it is.
Uh-huh. Because there's someone else, who would have been wrong. I understand, today, let's say it's a single rabbi who has an affair, because I don't want to get into if a married rabbi has an affair. Yes, he wrongs his wife, but whatever. Let's say it's a single rabbi that goes and has an affair, consenting adults, right? Anyone harmed by that? Not necessarily, but if there's money, sure it would be, right? But in terms of the integrity behind it, right? How do you know someone does tshuva? And then, we got this next Gemara here in Sanhedrin that hammers the point home. This is Sanhedrin 25a. The court suggested by Rav Idibar Abin, who said, he was suspected of...
Let me take a step back. So in this analogy,
yeah.
The thought is that tshuva is not sufficient. The tshuva requires the restitution.
Very much so. Absolutely.
The assumption is that the tshuva will be done, but that tshuva requires restitution.
Exactly. But not only that, but here it seems like until you know that he did restitution, you're allowed to, doubt him, which also shows you a certain matter of transparency. Right? It's almost like heading to a higher standard. Like, if I owe many somebody, it's like, give like regular guy, fine, give money back. But if the community knows that, hey, the rabbi did something wrong involving money, and let's say everyone knows it's actually wrong, but not a whatchamacallit, but not, you know, oh, we actually have a disagreement. Because let's face it, there are some, you know, monetary disagreements. That's why you have, you know, court cases and like, and they're two sides. But let's say everyone knows I did something wrong, pay it back in public. Transparency is like, okay, did something wrong, you do it, move on.
Now, in the case where there is harm in the sexual relations, is an apology required for
it gets a little more complicated with the halachic rules about those, way off topic. It's a wonderful question, but way beyond the scope of what I can do here. Anyway, Gemara Sanhedrin 25a, the course suggested by Rav Idi Bar Abin, who said, he who is suspected of passing trefot cannot be rehabilitated until he leaves for a place where he is unknown and finds an opportunity of returning a lost article of considerable value or of condemning trefa as trefa meat of considerable value belonging to himself. This is an incredibly important halakha that gets right to the heart of what exactly is teshuva, what exactly is repentance. So here you have a person, right, a shochet, you know, a communal professional, who is found passing off non-kosher food as kosher. You can't trust his hashgach anymore until he gets put in a situation where he, has the risk of loss. And shows that he's putting, let's take it a step back here. Remember we said earlier, Tamid Chacham is someone who is willing to say his own food is treif. I mean, assuming it is, right? And one of the things we mentioned is, you stand by Torah even if there's a financial loss, right? So why do you pass off treif food as kosher? Because you don't want to incur a financial loss. You are putting your own money ahead of what the law is. So how is a shochet supposed to do proper, almost penance and tshuva, in order for him to be trustworthy to be reinstated? Well, if he's found in another situation where it's almost where he's unknown, so that he's not doing it for the sake of rehabilitating his reputation, but he's put in another situation where he says, you know what? I'm going to put Torah ahead of money? Then you know he's done tshuva. Who does this sound like? Does anyone know somewhat ring a bell? This is Rambam's definition of teshuvah gemura, complete repentance. When you are put in an identical or similar situation, and you choose not to repeat the sin, not for any other reason other than your repentance. Right? So in his case, Rambam's case, it's not because you're too old, you no longer have the desire, it's because you did tshuva. And here, right, I think this is why it's important when you're unknown. Meaning, did you really learn your lesson? Once you see you learned your lesson, you can get reinstated, right? So, you know, similar with the case that I mentioned at the beginning, one, like, someone leaves the position, all right, you know, that's it, end of story. Someone needs to go do tshuva or whatever, and then reinstate, and that's fine. But you need to have that sense of finality, and just like we want teshuva for ourselves, we also need to be willing to give tshuva to other people, right? And that takes a while, and it's hard. And it's hard to rebuild the trust. How do you rebuild trust? Well, you see, did they really learn their lesson? Did they actually work to improve themselves? Now, it's not always easy to fix everything in such a way, right? And let's face it, you know, if the shochet goes to another town and no one knows him, how is it going to get back that, oh, you know, he sort of fixed himself? But you think about it today, right? If once someone has a bad name, especially in a rabbinic field, think about how quickly you are to say, oh, so-and-so messed up once, we got to get rid of him. Right? Now, to, you know, the credit, unfortunately, I shouldn't say credit, to sort of understand the skepticism or the cynicism, very rarely do rabbis own up to mistakes, especially big ones, or do they take the necessary steps. Right? Rarely do you find someone who's caught in a scandal who says, I was wrong, I need to step down on their own trail. Sometimes they may get forced to do so. And even they get forced to do so. Like, let's say, the truth is, rarely can someone, like, force go, whatever. Very rarely a rabbi is going to own up to their mistakes and say, I made a mistake, I'm going to step down. Right? And because of that, it's, you know, people are going to hold grudges, like, oh, so-and-so is dishonest. But if you think about it, a rabbi who steps down after being caught in a scandal, because says, you know what? You're right. I was wrong. I need to do something. I need to, you know, either remove my position, I need to work on it. Whatever they do is, in fact, a sign of integrity, right? It's not the fact that you never do anything wrong, because people make mistakes, right? Or let's say someone who doesn't have integrity, it's possible for them to develop integrity, but you got to work on it. A rabbi who actually, you know, admits a mistake, says I was wrong, takes necessary steps, ought to be welcomed back completely when they come back. That's simple. But it's really hard for people to get over that. Right? So I don't know, like, in terms of a chicken and egg problem of it, is it because that we as a Jewish people are so unforgiving that we're so unwilling to admit our mistakes? Or is it because rabbis don't admit mistakes that people are going to be unforgiving? Right, so here's where, you know, that, you know, getting back to what we said at the very beginning, the relationship between the masses and, massses, bad word here, the laity and the rabbin, it is so crucial, because it is supposed to be a relationship, right? We cannot, we do have high ethical standards for rabbinic leadership, as we discussed. But on the other hand, we also have to acknowledge that rabbis aren't perfect too. And instead of having this, you know, almost an adversarial relationship, of like, well, it's the rabbis versus the laity, and they're constantly butting heads and having this game of chess, we ideally ought to be working to make each other better. Good rabbis have a lot to offer people. And in turn, people have a lot to offer rabbis. And if I think both sides can work together, right, then I think we could actually have a much better Jewish community. But unfortunately, the relationship, I think, between the laity and the rabbinate is really messed up in many, many communities, like in terms of individual shuls, certainly on the broader scheme, because there is so much disconnect between a rabbi and the typical person on the street. And this has probably developed over a whole lot of time for a whole lot of reasons. But it's something that we need to acknowledge. And I don't think it's going to get fixed until the rabbinate and the laity, you know, are able to just sit together and have conversations exactly like this, where we can start talking about, you know, real expectations.
I'm just going to say this is very interesting, because the dynamics that you're talking about are similar to what's going on in healthcare around something called just culture, which is an environment where people can actually acknowledge wrongdoing and where it's not held against them. So I think, you know, for me, the question would be, is this something that happens when there's a public humiliation, someone does something wrong and it's publicly revealed, or does it come forward even when it's not publicly revealed? Mm-hmm. So the just culture world is a little bit different. It's not necessarily...
Right, so in the healthcare field, you're worried about getting sued.
Right.
In the rabbinate, I'm worried about losing
perception,
my job.
Right, it's the perception.
Right?
It's also the perception, can you lead anymore once you've committed this...
Right.
Atrocity or this.
So unfortunately, it takes a certain refined laity to appreciate someone who may admit a genuine mistake. And unfortunately, many people are not at that level to appreciate, you know, hey, someone, you know, like sometimes someone steps, you know, if someone steps down, you know, people will still like try kicking him when he's down. Right? And like, no, someone's like, that's it, let him be. Like, you know, look at, say, the Anthony Weiner case. He is never going to live down, you know, the scandal that brought him down. And I'm like, look, is it something that I felt he even needed to resign over? We could argue that. But he resigned. He'd like to make a comeback. Do you keep holding that against him? Right? If so, Helen, what's your statute of limitations? As a public, we are not that forgiving. But to say, you know, but also you could argue, well, you know,
kept... You get TV host shows, right? Governor Spitzer became a TV host.
Yeah, but you know what? Late night hosts are still making Clinton jokes about Monica Lewinsky, right? So, you know, he's kind of past it. You could argue that maybe there's a difference between actually admitting it versus denying it. Like, how do you respond immediately, right? Do you get caught up Petraeus, right? You know, he got ahead of it, admit it, you know, whatnot. Can he work back in public life again? Probably not.
But he only admitted after he was outed.
Well, that's
the question.
Well, that's also something else. Are you apologizing for what you did, or are you apologizing because you got caught?
Right, that's what I'm saying. So there's a big... Right. That's why...
But even apologizing once you get caught is something, right? Because there are people, even after they get caught, denied out the wazoo until they absolutely can't anymore.
Bill Clinton, that was the big issue with Bill Clinton.
Defining all these terms here. But, you know, Weiner would be a good, you know, relevant example because he denied it for a while. And I was like, okay, fine, you know, I was wrong in the denials. You know, coming out and you know, that's an issue too. Like, when you're caught with something, how do you respond? But if the laity is going to be unforgiving, then again, it's what comes first, chicken or egg. If you have a community that can accept, you know, like, yes, there is going to be loss of trust, but that has to get rebuilt. And if you want that for yourself, you should want that, you know, you should be able, you know, willing to give that to the rabbi too. Are there going to be certain unforgivable sins? Sure. And we could probably argue, you know, what those are going to be. But you have to at least, you know, keep that in the back of your head. It's like, you know what? We can't do this anymore. Like, you know, that's gone. But otherwise, you step down, you served your time, or whatever it is, depending on what the offense is. You got to be willing to look past it. And, you know, unfortunately, the laity that I know of, you know, often isn't like that. And I don't know, again, what comes first, but I would certainly attribute it to a lack of discussion over ethical living in Judaism, both from the side of the laity and from the side of the rabbis, where it's not even part of the discussion, such that even rabbinical schools, the professional schools, don't deem it necessary to sit down and think, hey, you're going out in the world to be a rabbi, let's talk about this, and have a real sense about the rabbinic professional ethics. And just one final thought. This is a derasha that I heard from my father's Rebbe Chacham Yosef Faur, Gemara that many of you may be familiar with, as we say in the davening often. Rebbe Lezer, the name of Chanina, said, the disciples of the wise increase peace in the world. As it says, all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children. Read not Banayach, here's another Al-Tikri for you, Ela Bonayach, rather your builders. So he says, what does it mean, Talmidei Chachamim Arbim Shalom Ba'olam, that the sages increase peace in the world? The way Chacham Faur explained it, if you find someone who might be knowledgeable but doesn't actively increase peace, you know he's not a real Talmid Chacham. I don't know if that's necessarily what the pshat is in the verse here, but it certainly shows, you know, I think the level and the goal to which we ought to adhere and to ascribe. And it is my hope that at some point, you know, with, again, this is only an introduction. This is, you know, these are cherry-picked sources. There are dozens and hundreds. And this is just the Gemara, mind you, right? Fine, one pasuk from Kohelet. There are hundreds of other sources that you could find. And hopefully people can use this to build a real honest discussion so that we can actually repair the relationship between the rabbinate and the laity so that both sides can not only behave more ethically, but foster an environment where ethical behavior is encouraged, where wrongs can be admitted, where people can apologize and get, you know, and, you know, really be forgiven, so that on a whole, we can actually create a world in a Jewish society that is a Shomer Torah, not just in terms of the knowledge, but of the underlying ethics and morals, to make it, as from the Gemara that we say, really, the Eitz Chaim Hi L'Machazikim Ba, right? Not just a tree of life, you know, for those who hold fast of it, but one that people want to hold fast of it too. Have a wonderful week.